This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
You know that old idea about stashing money in your mattress? Well, these days, PayPal and Starbucks cards are the new mattress. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, February 6th. Thanks for being with us. We will begin with an update in the trade war with China, which has perhaps begun the official cooling off period. China's government announced that it will reduce tariffs on more than 1,700 U.S. products. These cuts will kick in a week from tomorrow, and that's the same day American tariffs on some Chinese products are set to be reduced as well. Now, there was a time when this would be just an incremental step in the phase one deal. We might even note it in passing and get on to other things. But context is key here. As Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, this move comes as China is grappling with the continuing fallout from the coronavirus.
The human cost of the outbreak is growing. Hundreds dead and tens of thousands sick. When Deng Zhang teaches economics at Iowa State University, he says the risk that China's economy might not grow as fast this year has markets questioning whether the virus will
specifically impact China's ability to implement the U.S.-China Phase One deal.
He said that's part of the reason China is reducing tariffs.
This step brings some of the certainty and shows China's willingness to continue carry out the promises in the Phase One deal.
The White House has expressed concern China might need to delay some parts of the deal, like promised purchases of U.S. agricultural products. Joshua Meltzer is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He says those purchases had people scratching their heads even before the virus outbreak.
Effectively, the deal requires China to double purchases, and it's not clear how this is going to be done.
Not just because there may not be enough market demand in China, but also because U.S. farmers need to ramp up production. Matt Slaughter is dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth.
That depends on not just the investments they make in their seed and fertilizer and all those things, but the vagaries of the weather.
Slaughter says whether China can stay on track with the Phase One deal objectives will depend on just how bad the human and economic costs of the coronavirus turn out to be. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Now to a story that is not in the cooling off phase. As we record this, the results of the Iowa presidential caucus are still in flux. The chair of the National Democratic Committee has called for basically a recount, and the future of technology in the election process is kind of up in the air. Nevada has said it will not use the app that the Iowa Democratic Party deployed to collect and report votes in its upcoming caucus. By most accounts, that app was very new and had not been tested well enough before it was used. But long term, it raises the question of what parts of the voting process do need tech innovation. I asked Charles Stewart this question. He's a professor of political science at MIT and a member of the Caltech MIT Voting Technology Project. Charles, thanks for coming on.
Oh, my pleasure.
What technology would be good for elections?
The best use of technology in elections is to do the things that human beings are bad at doing. Human beings are very bad at doing tedious things. The most tedious of those things in elections is counting the ballots. And so the best use of tech starts with a really well-designed system that uses computers appropriately to record and tabulate the votes, but then has paper systems that human beings can verify the vote, make sure that the computer recorded their vote properly, and that you can go back to the paper to verify the count if you have to in a recount or because you're doing an audit.
How big a market is there for what you have described and for election tech overall?
Well, there's a market for voting systems. What I've just described is a particular type of voting system. And there are, I like to say, 2.5 companies that produce these systems, meaning there's two large companies, and then there's a number of smaller companies. But it's a very small market, and people in elections have been hoping to expand that market, either by making it easier for new companies to enter or to find ways to take off-the-shelf parts and to create voting systems from, you know, kind of computerized components that are already exist, you know, iPads and HP printers, et cetera.
Let's talk about the competition piece, because it sounds like some big tech companies have actually been in this market, but then gotten out, right?
Right. The best and most famous story is that IBM was actually responsible for the proliferation of the punch card technology in the early 1960s, to the point where punch cards were either the most or second most common way that people used to mark their ballots in the country. In the 1960s, an internal report from IBM concluded that one day, inevitably, something would go wrong. And so the decision was made to sell that part of the business. And they were not the company that was blamed for hanging Chad in Florida in 2000. Now, these systems are in the spotlight. They're highly visible. And we know that there will be mistakes. It looks like those mistakes are really bad for business. It shifts the provision of technology from the really big providers to, you know, smaller and smaller providers.
How big a deal is the education part of it then when it comes to even, you know, the Democratic Committee choosing a vendor? We have to sort of like accept the possibility that the people involved here are just not that tech savvy, maybe at every level. And so what is there, you know, is there a solution for that?
I would bet on another scenario, which is that people are tech savvy enough to think about the typical tech applications that you might develop. And technologically, it's not necessarily a big problem. There are other issues, though, having to do with, you know, the scrutiny that the system is facing and the consequences for getting things wrong and the ability to vet the software and to try to break it and to, you know, basically make sure that it's bulletproof. I've seen a number of instances where people have just radically underestimated the complexity of building an election system of any sort, thinking that it, you know, it can't be any harder or more complex than other things that they've built. And they're often wrong.
What is, when something like this happens, then, you know, it sounds like on the one hand, you're arguing that there is a need for better standards and communication, possibly more competition. But what is the cost of an event like this to voters' trust in new technology?
I mean, the cost has to be pretty high because, I mean, first of all, you know, it's incumbent upon people running elections or caucuses to run them in a way that's, you know, it looks like it's free and fair. You know, most people who are not involved in this business don't recognize how chaotic it really can be. And whenever it looks like people don't know what they're doing, then it's not going to be good. My expectation is that as we move on to other states, I'm hoping that Iowa will fade in people's memories and this hit to democracy, you know, won't be as tragic as some people are worrying it will be.
Charles Stewart is a professor of political science at MIT. Thanks so much for the time.
Oh, my pleasure.
On Wall Street Today, if history has taught us anything, it's that markets love it when there's peace in the tariff world. Details when we do the numbers. There is a ton of money out there sitting around on gift cards and in digital wallets like PayPal and Venmo. And I mean a ton. In a recent speech, a member of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors said PayPal had customer accounts totaling $22.5 billion as of a few months ago. And together, Walmart and Starbucks have what's called deferred gift card revenue of like $3.5 billion. Add it all up, and the Fed says that's more money than the deposits at many banks. So, but what does that mean? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
LA attorney Adam Byrne has collected so many gift cards, they're getting hard to keep track of.
Oh, man. So I know I have two $25 gift cards to Kohl's. I have a $25 gift card to Chipotle.
He's got Starbucks cards, Target, AMC movie passes. He might never use them all. And that can make for some tricky accounting, according to retail analyst Sucharita Kadali with Forrester.
It's held as a liability on the balance sheet of books. It's similar to like airline miles.
Being on the hook for billions of dollars in unredeemed gift cards sounds bad for retailers. But Kadali says what matters is not so much the amount, but
how long has that quote-unquote liability been on the books?
Most of those cards are redeemed pretty quickly, within 8 weeks, according to marketing professor Dan Horn at Providence College.
The odds of a card being used after 3 or 4 years approaches zero.
And he says retailers are allowed to start counting a percentage of unredeemed cards as income after it becomes clear customers are unlikely to use them. In 2018, Starbucks claimed $155 million worth. In the accounting world, this is what they call breakage revenue.
It's lost value for consumers. It's a small benefit to retailers.
Except, he says, in states like Delaware and New York that count unused gift cards as unclaimed property and use that to plug holes in their budget. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
On the topic of clean air and climate change, countries in Europe have been acting with some urgency to try to lower carbon emissions. Britain's government recently announced that it will ban sales of new gas, diesel, and hybrid vehicles by 2035. That's a pretty big deal. And in Denmark, there's a new electric ferry that's apparently more powerful and can sail farther than any other before. From southern Denmark, the BBC's Adrian Murray took to the water.
The engines ramp up and we pull away from the harbour at Thunshavn. I'm aboard Ellen, a ferry powered entirely by batteries. Standing over radars and electronic charts, Captain Thomas Larsen steers a course for Eru, an island in the West Baltic Sea.
What I can see on these two screens we have here is a power management system. It shows me all my batteries and how far I can expect to go.
Carrying up to 200 passengers and 30 cars, Ellen sails a roughly 40-kilometre round trip between charges. That's 7 times further than any other electric ferry. Halfdan Abrahamsson from Eru Energy Lab shows me how the ship is powered.
Well, here we're seeing half of the batteries on board. They're split into two compartments, altogether 840.
The lithium-ion cells are stacked from floor to ceiling, and a ventilator hums as it keeps them cool.
Ferry shipping, in general, is very dirty business. Ferries, tankers often run on bunker fuel, which is just about the bottom of the food chain when it comes to products from refineries.
This new e-ferry replaces an older diesel-powered vessel. It's expected to prevent 2,000 tons of CO2 each year. In the onboard cafe, passengers welcome the change.
It don't make so much noise, and no smoke from the diesel. It's good.
I think it's a great idea also for the environment.
After a 70-minute voyage, the harbour is in reach. We're just coming into Eru now. The nose of the boat is lifting as we're coming into the dock, and soon it's going to be time for all the passengers on board to disembark. Ellen moors alongside the recharging station. A mechanical arm plugs in, and in less than 25 minutes, the batteries are replenished. This onshore power infrastructure, together with the batteries, were major outlays, and the EU funded two-thirds of Ellen's $23 million cost. On the dockside, e-ferry project coordinator Trina Heinemann tells me more.
In terms of establishing an electrical vessel, we are looking at a significantly higher cost. But then the operation costs are significantly smaller. We are paying maybe 25% of what you would pay for running a similar diesel vessel in fuel.
Roar Falkenberg is the chief executive of Sobu Shipyard, where Ellen was built.
Ellen was a prototype. I think then we will have to build the next Ellen. It will be only a bit more than a normal ferry. And if you look 3 or 5 years, I think the price will be the same.
Nordic countries have led a shift towards hybrid and electric-powered ferries. In China and the Netherlands, batteries are also being applied to cargo barges. But experts doubt the technology can be scaled up for big ocean-going vessels. Maria Skipper-Schwen is a director at industry body Danish Shipping.
It's a viable technology for the ferry sector, for supply ships, tugboats, etc. And I think, well, the common denominator for these vessels are that they operate close to shore. For now, you do not have the capacity either for the storage or the charging capacity when you think about deep sea vessels.
While battery power may not be the answer for large ships, Ellen is showing how electric vessels can sail further than ever before. In southern Denmark, I'm the BBC's Adrian Murray for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I meet people at Starbucks a lot, in restaurants, or just wherever they happen to be. That's where I go.
The peripatetic lifestyle of a mobile notary agent. It just means on the go. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 88 points. That's 0.3% to close at 29,379. The NASDAQ moved ahead 63.6% to finish at 95.72. And the S&P 500 found 11.3% to end at 33.45. Quarterly earnings continue to roll in. Twitter reports that it's seeing more daily users and beat analyst forecasts with quarterly revenue topping $1 billion. Twitter clicked up 15%. Facebook rose 0.3%. Yesterday, we talked about Casper. Well, it woke up on Wall Street today and lifted 12.5%. Bonds essentially flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at 1.64%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. The California Consumer Privacy Act is in effect as of January. It says that you, consumer, can contact companies to find out what personal information that company has about you and ask for it to be deleted. But there are, of course, a lot of companies out there that have information about you and not necessarily the obvious ones, like Facebook or Google. There are hundreds of data brokers that sell personal data to all kinds of other companies. Finding and contacting all of them is a large undertaking. Luckily for us, Laura Noreen, security researcher and vice president of Obsidian Security, is on it. Laura, thanks for coming on the program.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right. So tell me about this big project that you're working on regarding the CCPA and your own data.
Well, I was pretty excited that I live in California, and California is the first state to give me some rights to ask companies what they know about me. And I really do want to know what the data brokers know about people, because it's often far more than we would imagine. And it's also often far less. So I wanted to kind of get a baseline on what that is, then eventually maybe to ask them to delete what they know about me. So I use the only public registry of data brokers available in the US, which is put together by the state of Vermont, gathered up 157 email addresses of privacy contacts at these companies, and emailed them and asked them to know what they know about me. And for the most part, I still don't know. They have a long time to respond.
Really?
Yeah.
How long do they have? So they have a long time under the law to respond?
Under the law, they have 10 days to let me know that they even received my email at all. And they have another 45 days to respond to that email. And because it's the first year of the law, they have an additional 45 days if they can't quite get it together in the first 45 days.
And then let's differentiate, because I think when, you know, a lot of everyday consumers think about this law, they think about finding out what Facebook knows about you or what Google knows about you. And I think it's really significant that you're starting with data brokers. Describe what that is for people who don't know and why that is actually the place to start.
So a data broker is basically kind of a company that acts as a bit of a middleman. If you are any type of company, you probably need sales. How do you get those sales? You might go to a data broker and say, hey, can you please give me everyone who lives in a certain area who's likely to have a certain income or certain habits, and give me their data so that I can reach out to them by email, by mailing them, by calling them. As a consumer, if I can cut off that supply of my data, that's really powerful for me.
Right. So let's say you're not in California. Is any of this process that you're going through now useful to people across the country who might at least want to try to contact these data brokers and find out what information they have about them?
Yes. A lot of the big legal advisors have advised their companies just to go ahead and follow these practices for anyone in the U.S. But like, you can already opt yourself out of receiving direct marketing. Has nothing to do with CCPA.
And then I want to circle back to something you said earlier. You said that data brokers often have far more information about you than you expect, but you mentioned that they might have far less. What makes you think that? What's been your experience in that regard?
So I got a fair number of responses back from companies that just said, you know, you're not even in our database, so there's nothing to show you. And I tend to believe them. Maybe I'm too gullible, but I have done this for a long time. So some of them really do have far less. Maybe they have some ancient address for me and they've linked it through my email address and that's about all they have. That makes me feel a little bit better and also just a little bit worse because at least the ones that are accurate, you feel like they have some kind of controls in place. The ones that are inaccurate and kind of incomplete, it concerns me.
Laura Noreen is VP of Privacy and Trust at Obsidian Security and a visiting scholar at NYU Center for Data Science. Laura, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks, Molly. Have a good one.
There is a certain thing that happens with just about everything we do in this economy, from buying a new home to making some business moves, even personal issues like divorce or setting up a will and testament. And that thing is legal documents. You gotta do the paperwork, and it usually has to be notarized. So for today's installment of our series, My Economy, we hear from someone who specializes in making sure those documents happen. This one comes from Houston, Texas.
My name is Violet O'Brien. I am a mobile notary and independent signing agent in Houston, Texas. I would say probably 75% of the time I go to people's houses. I meet people at Starbucks a lot, in restaurants, or just wherever they happen to be. That's where I go. That's why you hire a mobile notary, so that they come to you instead of you having to go to them. During the housing crisis, when I was listening to all these terrible stories about how people were losing their jobs and losing their homes, we were busy. So it was kind of surprising because I thought, okay, things are going to crash and burn, but they never did. In Texas, we started doing a lot of loans to pay property taxes. Those became legal, and they just went flying off the shelves. I was extremely busy for several years during, you know, those times. So there's always going to be a need for paperwork, whether it's, you know, positive or negative. I've been doing this most of the time that my children were growing up, and I love the fact that I could always get my kids off to school and not have to worry about getting myself off to work every morning. In the beginning, however, I did do a lot of work at night, and sometimes when I was doing all that night work, I'd have to pack them into the Suburban and bring them with me. So we had movies and happy meals, and they learned to just troop along with me. My favorite thing to do really is adoptions. And I love doing those because I have three adoptive children. So I understand the importance of the moment. The baby doesn't understand it yet, but you might be surprised to know that most of the time those occasions are extremely happy occasions. There are also witnesses required for that. So I often use my oldest daughter, who's 21 now, and she loves coming with me to be a witness to adoptions.
How great is Violet O'Brien in Houston, Texas? Tell us what's going on in your economy at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out is feel good-ish. Earlier this month, Disney demanded a $250 licensing fee from a public elementary school in Berkeley that showed The Lion King at a school fundraiser. Now, to be sure, it's a long-standing practice to charge a licensing fee to show copyrighted movies in public places. Leaving aside what you think about that, coming after a cash-strapped public school after the fact was not a great look. And so today, Disney chairman and CEO Bob Iger said the company would apologize to the school PTA and donate to its fundraiser. Maybe there's a licensing exemption for public schools? It's a thought. All right, we got to go. A good day on Wall Street. The Dow added 88 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ up 63. That was 0.6%. And the S&P 500 was up 11 points. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Michael Lipkin, and John Gordon are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. And I'm Molly Wood. See you back here tomorrow, everyone. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.